Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Income inequality has been rising around the world for four decades, economists tell us. It's one of the biggest challenges of today's capitalism, along with carbon pollution that drives climate change. Well, a new book thinks about a fairer, cleaner world, but not in the abstract, not just the idea. It explores solutions being tried out now in parts of the world. Some are small scale. The book is The Alternative, How to Build a Just Economy. And the author is economics writer Nick Romeo of The New Yorker. Nick, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
I love the fable you begin your book with, a short story by Tolstoy about a peasant, and he starts to acquire land. Pick up the story and the moral.
Yeah, so he makes a deal whereby all of the land that he can cover walking in a single day becomes his. The further he walks, the further he wants to continue walking. He gets pretty far from the original starting point, and the terms of the deal stipulate that he must get back to the original point to claim the land. So his greed gets the best of him, and he is not able to make it back. He rushes back only to collapse and die at the very moment when the sun is set and the day has expired. And so the title of this story is How Much Land Does a Man Need? And Tolstoy is making a kind of moral point and also a little bit of a bitter joke. He ends up in only 6 feet of land. So all of us will be dead eventually. So what is the point of frenzied accumulation given that fundamental fact?
Yeah. Why start the book this way?
The story does have a kind of clear moral edge, but it also has a lot of nuance and interest. On one level, Tolstoy is kind of pointing out sometimes what looks like success in a deeper sense is failure. You can feel like you've succeeded only to realize too late that was not the life you wanted at all. A simpler, perhaps happier life was available to you.
You know, today's big picture idea of capitalism is often connected to British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. In the 80s, she famously said, "There is no alternative to what we have now." But in economics, there have been times when growth was much more equal.
Absolutely, yes. The title of my book, The Alternative, is a direct allusion, the Margaret Thatcher phrase, there is no alternative. And the goal was really to showcase through reported examples from around the world all of the alternatives that do in fact exist to our somewhat disastrous status quo.
Well, let's talk about some of these examples. You traveled the world and you came across this chocolate company in the Netherlands, I believe, called Tony's, and it charges something it calls the true price. What's the idea?
Yeah, so true pricing, I think, captures a pretty basic intuition that the cheapness of many of the goods that we consume is an illusion. At Tony's, which sells chocolate bars, maybe it's the carbon emitted as you're transporting goods to market, maybe it's underpayment of workers who are growing the cocoa, they want to know all of those prices so that they can actually remedy the underpayment, or they can compensate for the carbon that was produced and the impacts on ecosystems. They want to know all of that. They don't necessarily pass that price along to the consumer. It can also just be an internal supply chain auditing tool companies and ultimately regulators and policymakers would use.
Oh, I see. So that is, you have a chocolate bar that might cost $4, but when you take into account the cost to the environment, the cost the workers bear, perhaps the true cost is double that. And you can either charge double or just take that into the numbers you crunch as a company.
That's right. And you could also imagine policymakers saying, we want to subsidize and support companies that are decreasing their true price. You know, the true price is going to vary. Chocolate might be different than factory farmed meat, and that might be very different than all of the rare earth components of a smartphone.
And I want to talk about gig workers, people who drive for Uber, say, you know, they get paid one gig at a time. A company like Uber might take a cut of 30-40%, leaving a lot less for the worker. But you write about efforts to chop that profit margin down to maybe 2 or 3%. So there's more money on the table for other people. How does that work?
So the basic idea here is a public utility model. In the same way a road system or a water network provides a public service, what if we had the digital infrastructure that enables these kinds of economic transactions, delivering food, giving a ride, but maybe also types of care work. If all of that functioned as a public utility, the profit motive goes away and the cost per transaction, so the cut that gets taken, could be much smaller because basically you're paying to keep the service functional and you're not trying to satisfy a return on investment expectation.
So you're arguing there is a way societies can make gig work much better. Because as you know, there's an argument that, you know, the whole concept of gig work, we should try to get rid of it because it's bad.
That's right. The argument here is many people want and like gig work. There is something appealing about the flexibility. What if we could make it more humane? What if we could make it better paying, give people more options, and have it fundamentally serve the public interest?
And is that being tried out anywhere?
You know, it is. There are municipal examples trialing these kinds of public options. One of them is in California. I know that there's also interest in cities around America, and there are governments around the world that are taking this quite seriously.
Another thing you look into and write about is what's been dubbed the purpose economy. And a lot of us have heard the old saw, the purpose of a company is to take its profits and plow them, give them to the investors, give them to the shareholders. That's the purpose. You argue that there are models of companies that have a different purpose, mission-driven companies. Do you have an example to share?
Absolutely. One of the companies I write about is an optics manufacturing firm in upstate New York. The retiring CEO decided the purpose of the company was going to be jeopardized if he simply sold to the highest offer upon retirement. So instead, he used a legal vehicle. Sometimes these are called perpetual purpose trusts, where that legal instrument is now the owner of the company rather than any one individual. You can stipulate a purpose for the company other than profit maximization. So it could, in fact, be profit sharing. This firm I'm describing, they share quite generously with all of their workers. Other folks who are using purpose trusts will stipulate other purposes. It might be hiring formerly incarcerated workers. It might be donating a stipulated percentage of profits each year to a nonprofit that works on environmental issues. But it's a way of dethroning profit maximization as the basic function of a company. And with the looming retirement of so many business owners in the baby boomer generation, there's a real opportunity for transitioning many, many businesses in many sectors across America to these more pro-social models.
One last one, if I can ask you about, you described this construction site in Oslo, Norway. It is silent. It is a zero emission street widening process. And you say this is the result of something called climate budgeting. Tell us about that.
Sure. Yeah. So the climate budget program in Oslo is one of many examples around the world. And the way it functions is every department in the city has a target for reducing emissions, and they have to meet that target annually. The construction site in Oslo is the result of this process where the city looked at major sources of pollution. They found that construction was a culprit. And so the intervention was to use these zero emission vehicles to change some of the building materials they were using. And you can see how this would ripple through an entire city, state, or even country. So it could be everything from changing what's served at school lunches to changing traffic patterns in a city, to changing the way buildings are made and the kinds of construction equipment that are used to make those new buildings.
You know, these are fascinating examples you have in your book, and they're small scale. Is there any guarantee that any of them are going to scale?
I don't think there is a guarantee. I think it would be false optimism to say, we know that these more humane and sustainable forms of capitalism will inevitably triumph. I don't think we have that guarantee. What I'm hoping to show in the book is we also don't have a guarantee of catastrophe and continuing on our current course. We actually have a meaningful choice. And so by looking at some of these more hopeful models, I'm trying to nudge us in that more hopeful direction so that we make a sustainable choice.
That's Nick Romeo. He covers economic policy and ideas for The New Yorker. He also teaches at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. And his new book is called The Alternative: How to Build a Just Economy. Nick Romeo, thanks much for the time.
Thank you, Scott.